Welcome to City Club of Eugene, July 7th presentation, Opioids. This is the 37th program in our current programming year. The City Club brings together civic-minded people to make Eugene a better place to live, work, and play. We are a member-supported nonprofit. Our members have direct influence on public policy. Become a member of City Club of Eugene at cityclubofeugene.org. Support for the City Club is provided by our members and sponsors, including Sacred Earth Botanicals. The coordinator of today's program is Marty Wilde, Executive Director of the Lane County Medical Society. We'd like to thank the Lane County Medical Society for their assistance in putting on this program. Opioids. It is a current topic. There was a report issued by the CDC just the other day that there's been a slight dip in the amount of deaths and opioid addiction, but still much work remains to be done. Over 180,000 people, I want to make sure I have it right, nearly 180,000 Americans have died in the last 15 years from opioid addiction. 180,000. There are efforts being made in the United States and in every state in an effort to reduce the amount of addiction and reduce the deaths caused by the addiction. Today's speakers will include Dr. Elizabeth Maxwell, PhD in public health. She serves as the Alcohol and Drug Prevention Coordinator and the Prescription Drug Overdose Prevention Coordinator at Prevention Lane. Maureen Jenny, the Clinical Director of Emergence, will discuss community programs that assist those dependent on opioids in recovery. And Judge Ilsa Rook Lay, Lane County Circuit Judge, will talk about Lane County's groundbreaking drug court. Ladies.
Okay, so like he said, my name is Dr. Elizabeth Maxwell, and I'm the Prevention Drug Overdose Coordinator at Lane County Prevention, and so I'm really happy to be able to talk to you today about this really important, significant topic that, as Joel pointed out, affects a lot of people, and there's probably nobody sitting in the room who is not affected in some way by this. So I just wanted to give you a little bit of background. He talked about some national statistics. In Oregon, in 2013, 156 Oregonians died as a result of prescription opioids. In that same year, 1,510 Oregonians were hospitalized due to intentional or unintentional drug poisonings. The cost of this care was estimated at $9.1 million. And misuse, 212,000 Oregonians self-report non-medical use of prescription pain relievers in 2013. So that's the scope of the problem, just a few statistics in Oregon. And then in Lane County, we have a higher rate of opioid prescriptions being prescribed per 1,000 residents than the state numbers. So Lane County has a higher rate. We also have more overdose deaths in Lane County. And we also have a higher percentage of our children in 6th, 8th, and 11th grades who think it would be easy to get prescription drugs not prescribed to them. And so that comes from survey data that they report. And so that's fairly concerning. Some other things that are kind of concerning about Lane County is we have a pretty high number of kids who report living with somebody in their household who's either using drugs, has used drugs, and also alcohol, who's misusing alcohol. I know our topic today is not about alcohol, but I just put that out there, that we have children in our community that are, you know, suffering some ill effects. Maureen will talk about the treatment aspect, hopefully that can help some of that. So Lane County was designated kind of a high need area because of some of those numbers that I just talked about. And so that's how my position came to be, the Prescription Drug Overdose Prevention Coordinator. So we actually have a grant from Oregon Health Authority, and so it funds me to do some special things in Lane County to try to stem the tide of the addiction and the overdoses in our county. And so one of the things that we have established is a pain guidance group. And the pain guidance group, we've had 4 meetings to date. It's quite a few medical providers. And I don't know if any of you either have been medical providers or have had to go to meetings. They like to do meetings at 7 in the morning, which is awesome for the rest of us. And so the reason, obviously, is that seeing patients starts at 8 a.m., and so they have to meet before that. So we have got representation from Peace Health, from Kaiser Permanente on the Pain Guidance Group, HIV Alliance, Serenity Lane. I'm probably leaving someone out. Emergence should come. and so it's kind of a new group, and so I really invite anybody who's interested, who's hearing me today in person or later on the radio, if you're interested in that, please contact me. I hope that my contact information will be on the City Club website, and you can contact me if you would like to be a part of that group. It's pretty heavy on medical providers because that's where we're putting some of our focus in trying to reduce the number of prescriptions that are being prescribed in Lane County. The other thing we're doing as part of that group is setting some monthly educational sessions for prescribers. And so the first one is starting in August, and then we've got one set in September. And so those are going to be evening events. They're going to be at Valley River Center, kind of like this, with a dinner provided at a nominal cost, CMEs. And so prescribers can come to that and get some education about, you know, how to responsibly prescribe, how to deal with patients who are having chronic pain, how to deal with patients that have maybe, you know, been prescribed not by the current prescriber, but a past prescriber, maybe have been on, you know, a high dose of opiates for decades, and, you know, how does a prescriber deal with that? So those are some of the topics that we're talking about having. And then the other thing that I do is help with the Prescription Drug Monitoring Program, also known as the PDMP. And so that's a statewide database. All states have it. It's a system for trying to monitor patients who may have more than one prescription for an opiate. Sometimes it's because they're willfully doing it, the doctor shopping, so to speak, but sometimes it's not. Sometimes it's that a person really doesn't know. You know, not everybody in this room or anybody listening knows what all the opioids are called. They have different, you know, names through the pharmacy. Sometimes patients don't know the risk of being on a benzodiazepine along with an opiate. And so what we want is we want prescribers to be looking in that database for their patients to see if they're being prescribed an opiate or something else that might be risky, you know, for their patient. And they track that. Pharmacists also have access to that list. And so the problem is that not all prescribers are signed up on that list. So in Lane County, we're currently at about 76% of our prescribers are signed up. So it is specifically my job to get us up to about 95%. So if anybody in this room, anybody listening, if you're a prescriber and you're not on that list, please, please get on that list. My office floor is littered with letters that need to go out to prescribers to encourage them to get on that list. And it's a little bit onerous, you know, it's not fun to sign up for, but it's a small thing. And then prescribers can actually designate someone in their office, so it can be a CNA or, you know, somebody, a nurse in their office can actually just look up the patient and see what they're also taking. And then pharmacists can do that as well. So Marty had said that he was thinking that maybe I would give a little bit of background, and I don't know if I feel quite qualified to do that, but this woman is, and I just happen to have this in my bag. This is Dr. Anna Lemke, who I saw speak at the Ashland Chronic Pain Conference this past May. Really small book, and so she kind of talks about the history. There's also a great book by Sam Quinones, which probably some of you have seen, Dreamland, a little thicker, but he actually goes into more about the heroin issues that have happened as a result of some of this you know, risky prescribing. So I would encourage you to take a look at one of those, and there's other ones as well. So the other thing that I'm working on is pharmacies. So some of you may know that in Oregon, we passed a law that pharmacists can now prescribe something called naloxone. Some of you might know it as Narcan. And what this is a reversal drug that can be given if somebody actually has an opioid overdose in front of you. You know, they're at home, a loved one, something happens, they take too much, they forgot a dosage, something, you know, they're taking a couple things, and so they overdose, and so this drug can be given either nasally or injected, and it actually reverses the effects. It can save a life, and so we're really trying to get pharmacists, they see a prescription come through, it's on kind of a high dosage of a opiate, and so the pharmacist can actually say, hey, you know, let me do a little bit of education here, you know, you might want to think about a prescription for naloxone. One of the other things that I'm doing is we're going to work with some local pharmacies and try to get posters put up that actually encourage, you know, you go in and, you know, you see that your loved one is on kind of a high dose of opiates, then, you know, you can actually ask and say, oh, you know, my spouse is on this. Is naloxone appropriate for us? What we would like is we would like for the prescriber to actually prescribe the naloxone along with the opiate, but that doesn't always happen, so that's why we have that legislation. And then we have our drug drop boxes. The other effort that we really want is to keep the opiates out of the hands of people who they are not prescribed for. So, you know, probably most of us in this room have had a situation, you know, you injure your knee, you do something, get a prescription for, you know, 20 Vicodin, you take two, didn't work, you didn't like it, your knee feels better, and then it sits in your medicine cabinet, right? Well, it's at risk, right, from any children or teenagers that might come into your home, or, you know, if your house is robbed or something, then somebody could get those drugs. So we really encourage you, we have 9 drop boxes around the county, so we encourage you to get rid of those medications so that they're not out there. And then just lastly, we kind of think of it as a three-legged stool. We want to educate providers, prescribers, so that they prescribe more responsibly, reduce the number of prescriptions that are being prescribed, even reduce the number of days. You know, all of us can think about, you know, having your wisdom teeth out, or you've had a child that had their wisdom teeth out. Some oral surgeons, you know, in the past have said, well, you know, you have your wisdom teeth out, that's 20 Vicodin or whatever. And so we really are encouraging you know, prescribers to prescribe individually, you know, to think about, does everybody need that prescription? Perhaps not, you know, prescribe individually. I was fortunate enough to go to a meeting of the Lane County Dental Society, and they had a speaker, an oral surgeon from Southern Oregon, and she said she doesn't do that anymore. She says, you know, Tylenol for everything, and then the patient can call if the Tylenol is not working well enough. And then just to educate the public, right? Opioids are not without risk, and so we want people to know that. There's other ways to deal with pain. There's acupuncture, there's massage therapy, there's cognitive therapy. There's other ways. The opiates are not the only answer, and some studies now are even showing that they don't even work that well for pain, but they are really addictive, and so that's kind of one of the reasons we're in the mess that we're in. So right on time. Maureen?
Hi, I'm Maureen Jenny from Emergence Addiction and Behavioral Therapies, and I'm the clinical director there. I want to talk more about what happens when somebody does get into treatment, and we always start with an assessment to try and figure out all the needs that the person has. And so one of the structures we use for that is from the American Society of Addiction Medicine, which gives us a structure for looking at least 6 areas of the person's life. So we want to know, when did they start to use? How did that occur? What age were they? How deeply did they get involved? At what point in their life? And then how long they've been using? Has there been a progression through other kinds of drugs to this point? Or did they have an accident or surgery that led to using opioids that left them physically dependent, and that they then started to seek them out after the prescription expired or they could not get any more? So we look for the maturity level, and also in general, how is the person doing in life prior to developing this problem? So are we looking at the need for rehabilitation, where the person was pretty functional before and now they need to really reorganize their life so that they can focus on a recovery lifestyle? Or is there really a need for habilitation, as it's called, where basically they had a difficult background, they never really got certain skills for living well, and now they have that to develop along with trying to stay away from use and maintain motivation for recovery? Okay. So we look at all the unmet needs, and generally if somebody's been using opioids for any length of time and they've gotten to the point of injecting them, they have some significant health conditions, so they're going to need health care. And if they've been combining it with methamphetamine, which many people are doing in the last couple of years, there's more of a combination going on, then they may still have all the problems that go along with meth use. So they may have a lot of dental problems and other sorts of health conditions too, as well as infections that come along with needle use, etc. So we're looking at all those different areas. Then we're trying to figure out how is the person just basically, you know, how are they functioning? How are they, do they have a job? Are they looking at jail time that's pending for them because of their activities to support their habit? Are there any family members that are still involved with them, or have those relationships been so damaged that the people are just not really around anymore as a resource? Are there any healthy supports to call on, family, friends, other people, perhaps caseworkers or others that have an interest in the person? Or if they're a young person, is there anyone from school that they still have a connection with? If the person has been using for a while and they've been living more on the street or moving from home to home just to get by, then there's a greater chance that they may have infection with HIV/AIDS or hepatitis. So are those conditions active? So we look at all those sorts of things, too, about what their needs are going to be. And do they have a history of a head injury or chronic pain, as we've been talking about? And because that's going to need to be dealt with as well. And as Elizabeth said, there's a whole phenomenon of people having pain, and if they use a lot of drugs, particularly if they use methamphetamine along with other drugs, and it was a physical injury, they may re-injure themselves from the muscle tightening that happens with stimulant drugs, so that they keep the situation chronically fired up, and it's very difficult to get relief from the discomfort because they're continuously kind of re-injuring it on a certain level. So all those things come into play. And now, how does a person support themselves? Do they have any resources? How will treatment be paid for? We're really fortunate here to have withdrawal management services in town. We have Buckley Detox Center that's part of Willamette Family Treatment Services. We have Serenity Lane that will sometimes be able to serve those that have more severe health needs or psychiatric needs along with their detox needs in their new little mini hospital that they have out at their Coburg site. But for many people, by the time they get to this point, they have exhausted a lot of their resources, and so it's more likely to be public pay for their care. So we look at all the other drugs that are being used also. I'm trying to speed up here a little bit because I'm running out of time. It's just very rare that anyone's just using one drug. Usually it's anything they can get their hands on by that point. And then there's the complications of the drug interactions. People that are users often really love to have a benzodiazepine called Klonopin. And even if they're taking methadone replacement therapy, they often like to have that with the methadone because it feels more like being on heroin. So there's many issues then psychologically to help the person address also as they try to work on recovery. So are there other co-occurring mental health conditions? Did they have something pre-existing, or is it possible that the use of the drugs has induced psychiatric problems? And then certainly the lifestyle makes you much more prone to violence or to be the victim of violence, and so there may now be trauma. And many people that we serve in more the public pay arena where there's more habilitation needs have a history of trauma. And so there's a great deal of need to develop basic life skills and emotional management skills because they may not have ever had the nurturing because of the circumstances they came from that helped them develop distress tolerance or emotional self-soothing or other kinds of service, just the things that people often can take for granted that are really part of how to live happily without the haze of drug use. Okay, so I've mentioned withdrawal management. There's intensive outpatient. There's day treatment in our area where it's 20 hours a week, and then residential. It's rare that someone with a significant opioid dependence can get and stay clean in outpatient, even if it's 20 hours a week, because the cravings are so strong and they happen so repeatedly throughout the day because it's a short-acting substance. So most all of them end up needing to go to residential. So if they are in intensive outpatient, perhaps they've had some kind of mandate on them to go to treatment, and you're really working to try and help them get motivated, stay motivated, because the motivation can evaporate in the face of physical discomfort and psychological discomfort, because a lot of times opioids really are treating emotional pain as much as physical pain. So people need a lot of support and a lot of case management initially to help them reorganize their life so that they can hang in there long enough to get a bed in residential treatment, because it's a scarce resource. So that's often a lot of our attention in the early stages. And then really lots of motivational interviewing work where you're trying to help the person recognize what reasons they have for getting clean and the true cost. One of the interesting things about addiction is that in the early stages of using drugs, it's very rewarding, in part because you still have lots of natural dopamine. But after you've been doing it for a while, you've depleted your stores, and maybe your body has down-regulated the production of dopamine. So now, even when you're normal, you don't feel normal, and you can't feel happiness or joy. But you also store the memory of the first use as a wow kind of experience. And now you've got weeks and months of being in and out of jail, or maybe getting in fights or other very pain, abscesses, horrible experiences that you're having because of your drug use, and you're not storing a very vivid memory. So here's this much discomfort, and here's, the joy, but it just seems way out of balance. So we try to address housing and stabilization needs first, and lots of cognitive behavioral treatment to help people kind of recognize the thinking errors that they're pursuing, so that they can start to recognize the thinking patterns that lead them to the lifestyle that leads them to being so susceptible to triggers and relapse risk. And in some of our programs, we have very structured curriculums to help people move through that process. A lot of times people will use drug replacement therapies after they've gotten clean from opioids to try and maintain them and reduce the incidence of craving. So methadone, Suboxone is quite popular. But we have to really monitor with your analysis also to see that the person's using it appropriately and not trying to use other drugs on top of it, or not selling it, because then they can buy more heroin, which is a better high, et cetera. So there's a lot to work with to really support the recovery process. And then eventually you have to deal with the person's identity and who are they really, and is this a situation where the person has an identity that they can reaffirm and a life they can go back to, or is this a situation where the person really needs to develop that? Is this a young person who really didn't get launched and still is really working on who am I, what am I good at, what do I want to do, and having courage to face that? Because things are pretty competitive. It takes a lot to get launched. It's hard to get out of your parental home sometimes these days because it's hard to earn enough money to support yourself. So there's a lot of challenges in terms of identity and encouragement to have a plan for what you're going to do next. Okay, I think I'm out of time. There's always more to say about that, but it's time for the judge to come up and talk about drug court.
I'm glad I was here to hear the last two speakers, because then I got to change the entire focus of what I was going to be talking about. My name is Alyssa Rooklay, and I am our treatment court judge, and we don't call it, or I don't call it, drug court anymore, because drug court is too narrow, as far as I'm concerned, about what we do, and sometimes people are mandated to participate in my court to get treatment, and it doesn't necessarily have to be for drugs. So my treatment court for adults is called treatment court, my veterans court is called veterans treatment court, and my mental health court is called mental health treatment court. And I find those important distinctions and necessary distinctions, because one of the things that I express to my participants most is that they are not their worst day. None of us are. And if we spend our lives defining ourselves by our worst day, then I don't really see why we wouldn't get up in the morning. So I want to give you three different examples. I just finished my treatment court, my Friday treatment court. I saw approximately 45 people. We started staffing our cases at 8:05. I got into court at 9:10 and finished literally 12 o'clock and walked over here and called my own physician about needing a doctor's appointment this afternoon, which is another thing I wanted to talk about, how responsible so many providers in this community are in terms of offering opiates to people. So three examples. On my desk bench is a photograph of one of my participants who overdosed and died. And she's the first person I see every day when I sit down and look at my computer. She was young and smart and creative and lovely and worthy and kind, and she was an addict. And she was also still a child. She was only 19 years old. We did whatever we could to help her, and she had a terrible heroin addiction. She had been in jail for enough time, the last time she was in custody, for us to give her medically assisted treatment, and we use Vivitrol. And because our program was not up and running yet, I'm not blaming us, all right, I take a little blame, but because our program wasn't up and running yet, because it's hard to get programs running, there's a lot of medical and legal issues that interact in terms of having the sheriff's department be part of, and their medical being part of, giving Vivitrol in the jail. There's a lot of things that have to happen. And I'm proud to report that it is now happening, and it's one of the greatest things that can happen. So this participant, this little girl, did not have access to Vivitrol while she was in, and when I released her from custody, she looked her age. You know, there were times I'd see her and she'd look 39, not that that's old, but she was only 19. So she had been in custody, I'm not exactly sure, I know it was longer than 10 days, I might have held her at least 20, hoping that we could get her the shot, and if not, get her enough clean time that maybe she'd be able to not use. And the fact is, it does not matter how much you want to not use when you're an addict if you don't have the tools to not use. So she, unfortunately, was found deceased right inside the running trail at Amazon. I ran past her. I didn't see her, but I ran past her. And a day doesn't go by that I don't think about her. Success. Another gentleman, fast forward a few months, a young, hopeful, smiley, smart young man in custody, had been in custody for 30 days, wanted to be part of our treatment court program, had the big talk with him about, you've been clean for 30 days, you need to understand, you need to hear me. If you use, there is a high chance that you're going to overdose. He's clear as a bell that he's not going to use. He had every intention to not use, and he did. Wasn't in court that Tuesday, next Tuesday, maybe got out on a Friday, which I wish there weren't Fridays or that we had court on Saturday and Sunday. Don't tell my colleagues I said that. The weekends are hard for people generally if you're having a hard time in life, and they're especially hard for people who are trying to not use. He got out, he used. Thankfully, someone found him, rushed him to the emergency room. Narcan saved his life. And it's hard for me to not jump off the bench every time I see him and give him a hug, because I'm so glad he's alive. He, like this other participant, had every intention of not using, and I believe they employed every skill they did have, but they couldn't stop themselves. One person was lucky and the other person wasn't. The person who is lucky is now still part of my treatment court, our treatment court. He hasn't graduated yet, but he is a leader around the state while he is still participating in this court program in training Oxford houses on how to use Narcan in case somebody overdoses. He's doing outstanding work, as many of our participants are. Third story is a gentleman who was in custody, has been in and out of, oh, already? All right. Third story, the gentleman who got his shot on Tuesday was in court with me today and said, this is the first time since I've been 13 that I don't feel like using. So medically assisted treatment is something that our court fully supports. People are mandated or offered treatment court when they're charged with certain types of crimes. I'm not here to describe what the program is all about. I'm thankful that Emergence described a lot of what happens, because a part of Emergence is part of our treatment courts. And without Emergence, we couldn't do what we do. So our participants see me weekly for a few weeks, and they go through the program and eventually graduate, often are part of our alumni association. Our community has been very supportive of treatment courts, and various news stations have done stories about our participants. The program is stronger than ever. We recently received, and I have to read this part, a SAMHSA grant in the amount of, where did I write that number? It's $875,998. So almost $876,000 over a 3-year period, so that we could enhance our focus of the use of Vivitrol, have more case management, more support, peer support, helping people with co-occurring disorders, funding a full mental health therapist to work with our participants, and also funding for 3 participants, current participants, to travel to national conferences each year. So we are doing whatever we can to support the psychological, spiritual, physical needs of our participants. And I would love to be part of your meeting. 7 o'clock, though? I'll do it. A while ago, I sent out a letter to every medical professional that I could find a name or address for. And that letter was describing what my court does and a form. Whenever my participants need medical assistance and are prescribed opiates or prescribed any schedule, 1, 2, or 3 substance, they have to hand that letter to the medical professional, and that person will then know that the patient is part of treatment court, and to do their very best to prescribe as carefully as possible, knowing the history of that person. Many times our participants are not embarrassed about their being part of treatment court and will offer that up to medical professionals. But I think it's important that professionals do know that this person can be triggered by the use of opiates or benzos, whatever it is that's prescribed. And I've had nothing but positive responses from the medical community about our treatment courts, and I wish people would come and watch. So we are in session Tuesdays, Wednesdays, Thursdays, Fridays from 9 till whenever. Varies from noon to 1 o'clock. Veterans Court, a specialty court, is on Thursdays. Friday's courts are usually scheduled for, we have a representative from DHS who is always present, to help coordinate the situations that involve people who are justice involved and also child welfare involved. And with that, sorry I can't say more, and thank you.
You will have a chance to say more during the question period. Now we'll break for about 5 minutes for the tables to formulate your questions. Anyone can participate in the table discussion, but only City Club members can ask the questions. Thank you, folks.
This is KLCC Eugene 89.7, KLCO Newport 90.5, 89.1 KLFR Reedsport, and at 88.1 KLFO Florence, KMPQ Roseburg, KLBR Bend. KLCC is a service of Lane Community College. We're on Facebook and Twitter and online at klcc.org.
Okay, welcome back to the July 7th City Club program, Opioids. Support for the City Club of Eugene is from members and sponsors, including AARP of Oregon, keeping Oregonians informed, engaged, and active, and PacInfo Internet Solutions, providing reliable internet solutions for Lane County. And now to members' questions. Marty?
Hi, Marty Wilde, LCMS director and member since 2010, I think. I had a question. I guess a lot of our docs are a little concerned about how do we coordinate with these pharmaceutically assisted sobriety programs. So we've got, you know, methadone where you have to go down every day, and then we have Suboxone where you take every day but it's not observed, to Vivitrol which you get a shot once a month, I think. But it doesn't seem like we're really coordinated across that. Do any of you have any suggestions about how, as a community, we might come together and make sure that people are getting the right kind of assistance for the phase of their sobriety they're in?
Maureen Jenny from Emergence. I think one of the things I would recommend would be that there would be regular urine screening. It wouldn't necessarily have to be extremely extensive, but you would want to see that the person was using the medication that had been prescribed to them and not using others, and really encourage that they address any mental health or other needs that they have, because that will really affect their compliance and also their success. They might need specific coaching about how to deal with the cognitive aspects of pain or other their other health conditions if they have chronic health conditions, and that can make a huge difference in their ability to really manage it well with the assistance of the medication.
Thank you.
Jerry Smith, City Club member, retired social worker, active in the homeless community. I'm greatly concerned that there aren't enough services to begin with. I can't refer people to any place that works right now. What the programs you're talking about sound totally wonderful. You all talk with a big heart. What do you do to protect yourself? What do you do for burnout? I can see that you run, but what about the others that you've got to do? And I don't think that's enough, by the way. I think you need a place to talk. I need a place to talk, and I don't have it right now. How do we keep from burning out when we care about those people that are out there in trouble?
Thank you.
This is Elizabeth Maxwell from Lane Prevention. So I also run, so I'm so grateful to live in Eugene and Lane County with all the wonderful trails that we have, and so I really take care of myself by getting outside. I'm also a knitter, so I'll put in a plug for knitting. I think it's a great kind of mind-soothing task. Spending time with family and friends, I think, is what really helps me. But you know, every day that I go to work, I just kind of like the judge, I just try to think, I don't want to
go home on any given day without thinking that I did something to help, you know, stem the tide of this epidemic. So if I can go home every day thinking that, you know, I put some effort and it was a good effort towards that, that's kind of what I do. So I feel great about my job. I love my job. I love Lane County, and that really helps me. So.
Hi, I'm Susan Conley, City Club member since 2008. Thank you all so much for coming. In my doctor's office, Oak Street Medical, they have a very well-structured program, and I've been taking headache medicine occasionally for 20 years, but in order to continue on something that I thought wasn't even an opiate, I had to come in, I had to have a big drug meeting, I have to go in every 3 months, I have to get a paper, I have to go in and get a paper prescription, and continue to meet. Now, the nurse practitioner told me that once they instituted their program, their percentage of their number of patients that were using opiates dropped by 30%. And I said, oh, drug seeking. She said, no, mostly people who had been taking them forever, weren't even sure why sometimes, and said, what the heck, I'll just try it without, something that simple. So my question is, Dr. Maxwell, do you see this in other practices, or is Oak Street Medical different?
So just to make a distinction, I'm a PhD doctor, not medical doctor, so I'll approach it from that. So yes, we are hearing anecdotally similar reports. And so I think, you know, from a public health perspective, what we would encourage is thoughtful prescribing. And so if a person has been on some kind of opiate for, you know, the last 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, and they are not having any, you know, things that the other two ladies have talked about. They're not in treatment court. They're not committing crimes. They, you know, are not in the DSM and having any problems. I think thoughtful consideration should be given. You know, we don't need to titrate probably everyone off of, you know, what they're on if it's working for them. So that's what we hope, is that just thoughtful prescribing is what we would advocate for, I think. Maybe Maureen wants.
I would just endorse that I think that there are some people who are maintaining without any of the signals or signs of addictive use, and that should probably be separated and dealt with separately from those that are having dependency and misuse of the substances, but still have pain that needs to be addressed.
Greetings, this is Paul Thompson. I'm a City Club member for quite a while. Thank you very much for coming. This is a question for all three of you, if you'd comment on it. You've spent most of your time, rightfully, talking about the victims of this, but we'd like to turn the attention for a second to the providers. And the question centers around, how do you identify offending providers? What jurisdictional questions are there about being able to interact with them? What punitive measures are available? Anything that you can fill in about what's being done to discipline that side of the equation?
I think this is Maureen from Emergence. I need to ask a clarifying question. Are you talking about prescribers? Or are you talking about people that are diverting substances from, like, in nursing homes and other medical practices?
The former, the prescribers.
I know there are times when we we're serving people that have diverted medications in their employment, that a lot of times they didn't intend to get involved in that. And I know I'm answering a little different question, but they didn't intend to get involved in that, but the deeper they got, the harder it was to get out of the hole that they were in. And I think sometimes there may be some prescribers who have had some personal experience with pain or distress and are very sympathetic, and others that are having 7-minute appointments with client after patient after patient after patient, and it's difficult to tune in. So there may be reasons like that are also involved.
If I may interject, in certain states, the Board of Medical Examiners does investigations into doctors who overprescribe or, in some instances, sell prescriptions. Does the Oregon equivalent of the Board of Medical Examiners do that type of investigation?
This is Alyssa Rookley. I have no idea.
Okay.
But I just want to respond to the gentleman real quickly. Education of prescribers is key. And prescribers are the ones who went to medical school and get to decide what's the best thing for their patient. And I would never attempt to tell prescribers what they should and shouldn't do. They're there with the patient. They're making decision in that moment with the information that they have. As long as they're educated, either by my participants who are telling them, look, I've had an opiate issue, I've been addicted to methamphetamine, I used to use a lot of cocaine, then maybe the prescribing will be different than it would be for a person who doesn't have that kind of history. But the education is the most important piece. And then for people who are having to take opiates as a result of an injury or anything like that, I think going in the way the last person described what happens at Oak Street Medical, first of all, the state of Oregon has decided that there are some prescriptions, I think all opiates mm-hmm. cannot be, or at least 1 and 2, yeah. You have to go in and get a paper prescription. And I think that it would be wonderful if every time someone got a paper prescription, they had to meet with their doctor to make sure that that is still a necessary thing. However, we want our physicians to make sure and have time for all the people who need them. So again, mandating that, it's up to each individual doctor. It's really important that we leave that kind of advice for them and not assume that they're doing something that's incorrect. Having more Suboxone providers in the community, yes, I would respectfully ask that more people provide Suboxone and the services attached to that. I would respectfully ask that there are more methadone providers in the community, because there are people with chronic pain who need to take these kind of medically assisted treatments that are authorized by SAMHSA and National Association of Drug Court Professionals. Those are necessary. The more providers, the better.
Jane Smith, City Club member. I've sort of concluded that I live in a bubble of naivete. Your information was very valuable, but for every piece of information you gave me, I came up with a couple of questions, like, where are the drop-off boxes? What drugs are opiates? What does an overdose look like? Do you have, in the marvelous program that you described, do you have relatively stable funding? Where does your funding come from, all three of you? And does
we
anybody...
We have to be out of here by 2
right.
o'clock.
Okay, I just want to give you the flavor. I'm saying I think you should come back. I would love to have you come back and reach my level of ignorance. And I have a social work background, and I spent 30 years providing private funding sources for social welfare programs and education. So I know the score, that we have very limited funds and people who just don't think everybody is worth saving, which clearly you three do. Do any of you have outreach workers? Where do your referrals come from? I think I'd like to end with that question.
Maureen Jenny from Emergence. I can say that we have both outpatient, which is kind of a low-level intensity, and intensive outpatient. We do not do residential, so we have to coordinate with other organizations in the state to get that sort of service for our clients. We get referrals from... occasionally from physicians or family members, but most of them come through some kind of legal obligation that they have. So they might have gotten a minor in possession or a drunk driving charge, or intoxicated driving, because it's often drug-induced as well. And then they may have also been involved with more significant criminal activity, so we have several programs that are intensive outpatient programs with cognitive restructuring, including the treatment court programs, that really try to deal with more of the whole person. And funding is something we pursue on a regular basis. Most of it is public funding and some fee-for-service. Some of it is private insurance. Oregon Health Plan has been generous in paying for treatment, so that is a large provider of funds to fund treatment these days.
Could you list some of the opioids?
If you really want to know a lot more about this, you might invite a very entertaining fellow here, Eric Martin, who's one of the directors of the Addiction Counselor Certification Board in Oregon, because he also does education about drugs. And I'm happy to share information about that in detail, but he would make it very entertaining and really help you know more of the effects, and which are short-acting, which are long-acting, that kind of thing. So methadone, Suboxone, Subutex, which is the same medication without naloxone in it. So then you can get high off of it rather than having it have a ceiling by the naloxone being in there. You can probably help me, Elizabeth, with some of the other drugs. Oh, hydrocodone, Vicodin, oxycodone, Percocet, OxyContin, fentanyl, morphine, of course, Apana, which we don't see as much on the West Coast as apparently they do on the East Coast. Lots of people are now switching to kratom because they can buy it legally, and you'll see it advertised everywhere. It's a plant from Asia that has opioid-type properties. That's kind of a current little issue for us. So because it can sustain a lot of the same behaviors and psychology as any other opioid would, so that it's hard for the person to really make a break with that past.
Thank you.
Name some others.
John Dolo, City Club member, and this would question, I guess, would be more for the judge. Are there any penalties for just being high on opioids or being caught with, or having them on your possession?
Alyssa Rookley, yes. I mean, that's called unlawful possession of a controlled substance, and even having a substance such as Vicodin that is not prescribed to you, or Percocet, or Xanax, if you are in possession of anything that is not prescribed to you, you are committing a crime, misdemeanor or felony, depending on what the actual controlled substance schedule is. So yes, absolutely. And then you're committing another crime if you're under the influence of one of those substances and impaired. You could be committing both a possession as well as a driving under the influence of intoxicants.
And what are the penalties for that?
Well, I say them every day. For a DUII, it's 1 year in jail and a $6,250 fine. And for a Class B felony, it's 10 years in prison and a $250,000 fine, and 5 years in prison and a $125,000 fine, but all subject to the sentencing guidelines, which we would need about 3 days here for me to say. It's a matrix, so that's all I can say.
Bob Cassidy, City Club member. Our table was concerned about the idea of addiction itself, and this is maybe toward Maureen's background. Is there a difference between an addiction to alcohol as opposed to the opiates in the person? Is there, you mentioned catching things early, and is that easier to take care of them, and why is that? Is it a kind of genetic thing for some people, and they're not easily addicted? That kind of information would be interesting to hear about. Okay.
So this is Elizabeth. So I just wanted to, I won't address all of it. I think Maureen probably is better versed. You bring up some really interesting questions, and I think the scientific community does not have one answer for that. You know, yes, biology is a factor. Yes, genetics are a factor. Yes, growing up in a family and seeing, people who use, drugs and alcohol is a factor. Growing up in a neighborhood where, those are the norms is a factor. Those are all factors. And just from a public health perspective, I just want to say for all of you that have young people in your lives, what we call a person who has never
had an opiate before as an opiate naive individual, and so you want to be really careful with those kids that are going to have their wisdom teeth out, or they go in for a sprained ankle and, you know, some nurse practitioner or medical provider gives them the 30 Vicodin. Really have a conversation about that and really think about that. In a person that has never had opiates before, there are documented cases that that's it, that one time is the time that, you know, oh, they really like that feeling and it triggers that addiction. So just want to put that public health message out there. And I think Maureen can probably address his question better.
This field has forever been engaging because of questions like that. What really drives it? And I, like Elizabeth says, it's really all of these things. And part of what you do when working with somebody is try to figure out what's their particular profile as best as you can. Guess that by the little clues in the way that they relate to the substance or the way they describe it. Sometimes just the exposure is enough to trigger a latent biological difference that makes it more rewarding than for some other person. And that's the same with any substance, and the same with gambling for that matter, because gambling does modifies your internal chemistry in a way that substances do, but without a substance. For people that get into compulsive gambling, they're stimulating their internal body chemistry in a way that's very analogous to drug addiction. But certainly, if you feel like you are not happy with your life and suddenly a chemical makes you feel better, that's part of the temptation then to keep using it more and more to the point that you develop dependence and then all the things that go along with that. It's pretty complex. There's things you could read if you're interested in more in depth. It's a hard thing to answer in a few sentences because there are so many factors, but it's pretty fascinating. And I'm sure you can find many things to read about that. Uppers, Downers, All Arounders is a book that was written that is used a lot of times in educating addictions counselors. And it's more superficial, but it's very interesting, and it gives you a good overview of the effect of all different kinds of drugs and then the interaction with the individuals, because there's also quotations from people. So that's one simple thing you could look for. You could probably find it at the library or in a used bookstore, that kind of thing.
Thank you. Sorry, James. The City Club is very appreciative of our sponsors, including Sacred Earth Botanicals, AARP Oregon, PacInfo Internet Solutions. And thank you to KLCC for airing our programs Monday, 6:30 p.m., and to Community Television of Lane County for televising recent City Club programs. Please be here next week, Friday, July 16th. Two state legislators, Democratic Senator Floyd Prozanski and Republican Representative Cedric Hayden, will share their thoughts on what went well and what could have gone better in the 2017 legislative session. Should be fun. More information about future programs can be found online at City Club's website, cityclubofeugene.org. And now let's give a big thank you and round of applause to today's speakers, Dr. Elizabeth Maxwell, Maureen Jenny, and Judge Ilya Rokele. That concludes today's program. Have a good weekend, folks.